everyone, and welcome to episode 109 of season 11. I'm very pleased to bring you another interview episode. This time I'm interviewing Malcolm Stone, who was the set decorator on all 10 episodes of Band of Brothers. So welcome to the show, Malcolm.
Hi, good to meet you.
Yeah, nice to meet you too. So first of all, you know, why don't you enlighten me? What does a set decorator do? What is the job of a set decorator on a movie, on a TV series set? You know, how does that work?
Well, after the art director has translated the production designer's ideas into architecture, in other words, temporary architecture, i.e. sets or locations, set decorator is responsible for all the furniture, fittings, everything that the actors handle and live in, the environment they live in. So you've got to find all the furniture for a room. You've got to have a lot to do with the armorer who supplies the weapons in a war film. And basically, you're looking to make an empty shell a livable interior. So you are analyzing the script. You have detailed meetings with the director and the production designer about the their concept of the people that the actors represent. So therefore, you are trying to put your mind into that conception that the director has of those people, those actors. So you're thinking about, well, if I was this person, what objects would I surround myself? What furniture would I want to live in? What ornaments would I want? And so you create basically an environment that an actor can believe, audience can believe, and the director believes in.
Wow. Okay. So how did you get into this field? What's your background? How did you what made you think that this is what I want to do in life?
I studied for 5 years to become an interior designer. And I worked in architecture for a short while. And I found my way into television and worked in television for about 8 years, becoming a senior designer. Then I took the step of going freelance. I worked with Jim Henson for 5 years doing The Muppet Show. And when he decided to make the movie Dark Crystal, I stepped into the freelance world and I became an art director on that. And I've been, which is quite unusual, an art director and a set decorator throughout my career, as well as production.
Oh, wow. How was that working with Jim Henson? I mean, I assume you were living in the States at that time.
No, he was. He made the Muppet Show in England.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah, yeah. I didn't know that.
They didn't have the courage to make it in America. They never liked doing anything new. But Lou Grade said, I'll finance your show, but you've got to come and make it at my studios in Elstree in England. And so we came together there.
Oh, wow. Wow, that must have been a great experience working with Jim Henson for all those years.
Best boss I ever had.
Yeah. We all lost him too soon, especially for people who knew him. You know, I knew his work. I didn't know him. You know, oh, wow. Okay, and then from there, so that basically catapulted you into the world of movies and TV shows as a freelancer, as you said.
Exactly.
Oh wow! Okay, and
I'd worked with Anthony Pratt before on mm-hmm. Santa Claus the movie.
Okay.
So we knew each other from there. Not as a set decorator. I was the art director in charge of making reindeer fly, which was a 2-year engagement.
Well, if they're paying you for those 2 years, then why not? And if you enjoy, especially if you enjoy your work, you know, that's the important thing.
Yeah. Certainly do.
Oh, wow. Okay, so I mean, when working as a set director, does it make a difference to you, the genre of the movie or the TV show? Because as you said before, the idea is that you have to get into the mind of the character, what's supposed to be in this room, what's supposed to be in this area, things like that. And I'm assuming there are people who specialize in, I don't know, war films, and people who specialize in period dramas and things like that. So
To a
how does that work?
degree, to a degree, but basically, the script is your Bible. I work with David Lean, and I always remember him saying to us as a crew, he said, "Stop asking me questions." And Robert Bolt and I work for over a year on this script. Everything you need to know is in the script. Read it. Don't bother me with questions. And
Interesting.
I've always taken that advice.
Yeah, no, I think it's great advice, but that doesn't answer the question of what's supposed to be in the room. That tells you that okay, the character is holding something in particular, but it doesn't tell you what needs to be around them. That's the thing.
No, but that's in your own creative imagination. And but you've also got to try and understand what's in the director's creative imagination. You've got to come to a compromise that both of you accept and like. And that doesn't matter whether you're doing science fiction, whether you're doing a war film, whether you're doing something contemporary. You're still trying to make the environment that actor is in believable, and or more than believable. People have just got to think this isn't a set; they're just thinking it's real. So you're
Right, of
creating
course.
an illusion.
Oh, wow. Okay, and so how did you get connected to Band of Brothers? Was it via Anthony?
It's through Anthony, yes. He interviewed me to be set decorator, and he took me on.
Okay, and I'm assuming you have a whole team that works with you. You don't do it
Oh
all on your own, do you?
yes, I work very closely with the property master John Allenby, my right-hand man really, and I mean he had about 60 men working for him on that. I
Oh,
mean,
wow.
for instance, take the concentration camp. Now, for the it's an interconnected story. For the Battle of the Bulge interior set, we had to recreate the forests of the Ardennes.
Right, that was
So
done all in a hangar,
that's
right?
right, in the hangar.
Okay.
So I had to, as a set decorator, I had to provide the trees that go inside that environment that was being created. So I went to an estate called Hatfield House, which is I've used for many movie locations. It's a beautiful period house, and I know, having worked there on other film, Willow, I worked on there on, I knew that they had forestry as part of their business, had pine forests. So I went to them so that I could purchase 40-foot-high pine trees, bring them on a lorry only 5 miles away to the studios at Hatfield, and then re-erect them in the airplane hangar.
Okay.
That meant a large area of the forest was cleared for those trees that I had chopped down. And so I told Tony about this because they were looking at a location that was about an hour and a half's drive away from the studios, which costs money, but this is 5 minutes away. So I took him to show him where we cut these trees down, and he had a ready-made clearing in a pine forest. So he jumped at that opportunity, having looked at it, thought it, because it just made sense logistically. And then, as set decorators, the art department build the design and build the huts that the people live in.
Okay.
But then the fence around it, the barbed wire fence, that's set decoration. And that was a big job that John Allenby took on. And you know, it was because it was you know, about 18 foot high, and it's again, it's made of tree trunks and barbed wire and everything else, and it was a big area to fence off. But and obviously you're working from period photographs, you're working from research, and it was built exactly as it would have been built around a concentration camp.
Oh wow, that's just amazing. And like the I mean the scope of this series, you know, takes you to so many different types of places, in order to, you know, very different places. I mean, you have you know, the barracks in Tekoa, and then you have you know, the forest, then you have the concentration camp, and you have you know, when they're in the eagle's nest, you have all these different things. I mean, so it must have been fascinating that you get to use different, you know, use many of your different skills for different areas all within one you know, one job.
Everything's based on thorough historical research. I particularly like it when directors and producers say to you, "I want this to be authentic." And you have to do your homework. I mean, we had a wonderful researcher called Celia Barnett, who worked with Tony on many pictures, and you know, she just brings photographs to your attention so that you can really get things right. And if you can't find that item, I mean, remember we're dealing with objects 70 years old. Then you make them, you manufacture them, and so that's basically part of it. I mean, I had probably even more problems doing the movie Fury, because the director there, he came from the world of documentaries, and he wanted everything super authentic.
Oh,
He
wow.
wouldn't. He didn't want any reproductions. He even when we built the inside of the tank, he even wanted the wiring sound system to be 70-year-old wiring, you know, that we you know you find from collectors
Oh, wow.
around the country. And it was, you know, almost the point of craziness on that film. But it was, I say, truly authentic.
And I mean, obviously, we're you know, in Fury, did the tank really work? You know, if you had to have an authentic tank from
Well,
7 years earlier, did
there are people who restore and collect tanks, believe it or not. There's quite a few of them, and you employ those people. But we had to build an interior of the tank. We had to build it about 10% bigger than reality in order to be able to get the camera in with the people in such a confined space. And the tank had to, it broke up into 17 removable parts so that you could take a piece out, put the nose of the camera in there. And so all my wiring had to break where you had a part, a piece taken out. So you'll go into quite minute detail to make these things work. And there are military collectors shows all around the country. I went to countless ones of those, purchasing stuff that people have collected and hoarded for 70 years. And there's quite a market in it, actually. And so I was continually buying bits and pieces from World War II military equipment.
Oh wow. And I mean, how much time do they usually give you beforehand to start doing all this research and preparation? Because,
On
you
that
know,
film, on that film, I had 14 weeks. It
on
nearly
Fury.
wasn't. It nearly wasn't enough.
Oh wow. And on Band of Brothers?
Band of Brothers was not so hectic, because we were making an episode. Well, we were filming an episode every 2 weeks, and obviously we'd had a quite a few months preparation time before that. So it wasn't as intensive as Fury. which was, well, it was a 90-minute movie as opposed to 13 hours.
Well, all right, okay. And I mean, did the veterans who were, did you interact at all with the veterans? Were they giving you input and saying, oh, well, you know, this should be this way, and this is what you need to have in this particular room in the set, things like that, or?
We had a little con. We got to know them more after the film was made, really. We had sort of written contact with them, and we and also the book that the film was based on. You obviously read that, and
Yeah, of course, but it doesn't have pictures.
That's right.
It doesn't have pictures to show you that, okay, this is the way the barbed wire fence should look, and this is the way that the barracks should look, and things like that, you know.
Well, again, that's goes back to the research. I mean, we you know we Celia found us all sorts of photographs of American wartime barracks, and we you know we work from there. And I mean, the I remember when Steven Spielberg came to have a look, he was quite impressed with the kitchen setup that I put into one of those barrack room huts.
Oh wow. So
He said
you
it was.
had direct interactions with Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks
Yeah,
also.
he came a couple of times, and I met him and talked with him.
Oh wow.
Nice
And
nice man.
he gave you advice, or he basically said this is great? You know, did he give you constructive criticism and say, well, maybe you should do this, this,
I
this?
mean, I'd previously done a TV series, World War II series called Monsignor Renard with John Thor as the main character, and that was set in wartime France, and we shot it in France. So I was able, I had a lot of experience in finding French properties, set dressings. And when I first started on the film, on Band of Brothers, I said, right, I'm going to France for 2 weeks. I want £10,000, and that may not be enough. I'll be gone for 2 weeks because I'm going buying. I'm going buying equipment. What I'd learned is that the French never throw anything away, especially you go to farms or farmhouses, and in their lofts and attics, they've got all sorts of stuff stashed away.
Oh,
So,
wow.
and I got hold of the French buyer I'd worked with on the previous film, and for those 2 weeks, he and myself and David Lusby, my English buyer, we went around northern France buying antiques and junk, really, but stuff that we could store and use that was authentic. I bought all sorts of doors from architectural reclamation places, because the style of the French door is different to the English door. And so I think I bought about 50 or 60 doors, which then construction incorporated into the buildings that they were doing. I actually got another £10,000 sent out to me, because I kept finding more and more stuff. And then got it, then shipped it all back to England. And this was right at the start of the preparation period.
Oh
So
wow!
I had
That,
to.
so they gave you a pretty much unlimited budget for this type of stuff, because you know if you're just constantly telling them, okay, I found something else, send me some more money to send it over.
I had my budget was £3 million, and
Okay, and is that a usual amount for this type of scope of a series?
well, the set decoration budget is usually about 20% of the rough rule of thumb of the construction budget.
Okay.
Very rough rule of thumb.
Yeah,
But
obviously, obviously.
I agreed this with the production manager, and we got towards the end of the picture, the money was running low, or the end of the series. And called me up and said, Malcolm, have you got any money left in your budget? I said, oh, yes, I've got a bit. She said, how much? I said, oh, about a quarter of a million. And she said, you crafty old bugger. You've just saved the picture because we can use that to finish the last episode.
Oh, very interesting. And I mean, basically, you not only do you have to buy all this stuff, but you have to find ways to ship it also. If you said you've shipped 50 or 60 doors,
Yeah. Well,
that's a
you fill trucks up and send them across the channel. I mean, I found some wonderful stuff in a scrap metal yard in there. The old guy who ran it, I mean, he was an elderly man, and this is going back to Monsignor Renard. We'd taken this town. And had a village, a square in the middle of it on the River Seine, overlooked the River Seine. One side of the square was missing because it had been bombed in the war and disappeared. We rebuilt that as scenery on that location.
Oh, wow.
And he, when I met him at his scrapyard, he said, "I've seen what you've done in the village," and he said, "I'm very pleased because it re brings all our old memories back and everything else." So he said, "I don't usually sell my stuff. I'm a bit of a hoarder, really." But he said, I will sell stuff to you." And I was able to buy these great big metal pylons, that was so French and not really. I'd have had to build the things if I'd have done it in England, and it would have cost me so much more money. And we were having a drink in his kitchen with his wife was cooking in the background, very traditional French place. The wine was the local, his local wine that was sitting there. And he said to me, look at that, the table you're sitting at. And I looked under there and there was a initials and a date carved into it. And the date was 1943. And he said, we hid an English aviator here during the war. I said, and the Gestapo came looking, and he showed me. He said, the door, it's a great big door open. He said, he stood behind the door while the Gestapo came in, and we kept them talking, and they never looked behind the door. And then
Oh,
we, he said, and then we passed him off to the resistance, and they got him home.
wow. That's an amazing story. And so
Yeah.
the initials are of the aviator?
No, I didn't find out who it was.
And
It
then
was.
what do you do with all this stuff after? I mean, there's things that you could be buying that are going to be in one shot, and then, it's not going to be needed anymore.
At
So what?
the end of the movie, I hold a sale, and the producers are happy if you get 10% back on what they've spent on it. Well, I was getting much more than that because all the collectors I'd bought stuff of, they wanted to come and buy it back again.
Really? Oh,
Yeah. So the producers are rubbing their hands.
so, I mean, most of the things that you buy, it's not a question of renting something. It's not like you could have gone and say, I want to rent these 50 doors, for a certain period of time. I mean, again, I
No,
don't know how that works.
it would certainly not work in that situation. There
Especially
are
since
obviously
you're blowing up some of the doors.
movie hire companies, as you know, no doubt know, and we do hire stuff, and but economically, it depends on the type of stuff, and it depends on the economics. If you're on a production that's going to last a long, long time, it's more economical to buy it and sell it afterwards than to rent it for all those
Okay.
weeks. But if you're
Right,
if 4 weeks is fine, but 12 weeks, you might as well buy it.
true. But I mean, like I know that the filming of Band of Brothers took about 10 months. Okay, but if you're filming Tekoa and it takes I don't know, 2-3 weeks to film that whole part of Tekoa, so you don't need it for the other 9 months that are going to be there.
Tekoa was built on the back lot of the Hatfield Aerodrome that we took over, and that was the first thing we shot. Then that's knocked down, and we're building something else there. We're probably building the Dutch canals, I think, in that area, if I remember rightly.
But, so once you tear that set down, at that point you start reselling the stuff back. You don't wait until the end,
you wait till the end. Wait till the end. We've got a big prop store. We keep that stuff because you never know something you might be able to reuse or might need to reuse. But at the end of the movie, you have the sale.
Right, but then you also have to keep track throughout the entire shoot to know what's there.
That's where the property department comes in, because the property master has a storeman and he tracks everything, knows where everything is.
Mm-hmm. Right, and obviously when you're doing a war picture, there's going to be things that are going to get destroyed also.
Yes, you obviously the stuff that's going to get destroyed, you make.
Right.
Basically.
You don't ever destroy authentic stuff.
You can't use a real rifle. You've got
no, obviously. No, but I'm talking about like the doors. I don't know why I keep coming back to that example. Okay, but you bought 50 doors. None of those doors are doors that are gonna, be shot through or exploded or whatever it is.
Remember, you're not actually blowing something up in a movie. It's a special effect illusion.
No, there's a special effect, but there's also the props. There are things that, I mean, you obviously know better than I do, but there are things that do get destroyed.
Yes, but then you plan for that.
Correct. And
you'll make a replica that you can destroy.
Okay. I understand. You don't destroy the actual artifact. You destroy
only accidentally.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
And of course that does happen.
Right. And through the course of a shoot, whether it's Band of Brothers or something else, do the actors also give you input? Do they say, hey, how come this room doesn't have this and this type of thing? And then you're like, hey, that's a good idea. Or you're like, no, this is the way it's supposed to be. This is what it says in the script. This is what we're doing.
I had a thing with Tom Hanks. Tom Hanks collects typewriters.
Yes. Everyone knows that. Yes.
And I was called on set one day and he said, why have I got a British typewriter? I'm an American soldier. And I said, perhaps you remember Lease Len, which was when the Americans sent ships and equipment to the British to use.
Okay.
I said, so there's no reason why an American reporter should not have picked up a British typewriter during his posting here. And Tom accepted that.
Okay. I mean, you do have the episode that Tom Hanks directed. It's Crossroads. You can definitely see the idea that he's putting in about the typewriter, because Winters is typing up a report throughout the whole thing, and you get a lot of shots of the typewriter. And I heard a rumor that Tom Hanks took that home. I don't know if it's true or not.
For his birthday. One of the producers,
Ivan Short,
said
Ivan Short.
That's right. He said to me, "There's a typewriter that Tom hasn't got in his collection. Do you think you could find one that we could give him for his birthday?" So my dear old buyer David Lasby, I said, "Okay, see what we can do." David rang up Christie's auction house and asked him about the typewriter. He said he He said he talked to this guy at Christie's. He said, "Oh, we want one of those. Oh, very common. No, we don't like those. And you have to go to somewhere else." So David found a man not too far away from the studios who repaired typewriters. And he said to him, "Have you ever seen this sort of model?" He says, "Well, I've got pieces of it. I think I could rebuild it." And
Oh,
he
wow.
rebuilt. And he rebuilt this typewriter, and that was Tom's birthday present.
Wow. I'm sure he was very pleased to get that. No question
Well,
about that.
the man who did the, we said, "How much do you want to do this job?" He said, "Could I have two signed photographs of Tom Hanks and my daughters? That's all I want."
Hey, why not? So, in other words, you gave it to him as a birthday present and said, we just need two autograph. The pictures from you in order. Wow, that's great. So what do you from your memory, what was the most challenging bit of set pieces that you had to deal with on Band of Brothers?
It was probably the forest, inside the that was a work. Different challenges to different areas. One of the big challenges was, I mean, as set, we also took on the greenery role because
Okay.
my property master was very capable of doing the greenery, and one of the producers said to me, "That's the smartest thing you did. You saved about $5 million by doing that." And so we had to, there was massive earth moving to landscape the area down, and then basically we had to grow crops in fields. We had to make the bocage, the French hedgerows, and we're starting in the winter. We're starting filming the early spring, and we've got to get all the stuff to grow, and that was really tricky. That was because the weather wasn't really in our favor, and stuff wasn't quite there to my satisfaction. And then I called a greenery company in to back it up with stuff they had in their collection, and so we got it together and we were able to get the shots. I would say about 2 months later, it looked absolutely fantastic because everything had
Wow.
really grown by then.
Wow.
We got it there by the skin of our teeth, really.
Right. Well, I also know that a lot of the set in Bastogne, the background parts were CGI. You know, they were adding they added in more I guess more trees in the background and stuff like that.
There wasn't that much CGI in Band of Brothers, not compared to what there is today.
No, obviously, you know, it's been 25 years and things, but how has CGI affected the work that you do? Has it made it easier? Has it been more cumbersome? You know?
I think when it's overused, the public know, and they aren't as satisfied with the project as when we film traditionally with, on with a film camera, and we built and we used visual trickery rather than CGI. It's definitely got its place. It does wonderful things in science fiction. It's like, in some ways, it can devalue the product. I mean, I did a film called Dark Crystal,
Yes.
and quite recently they made a prequel, a TV prequel for it,
Yes.
and they called me in for a couple of days to advise on it, and set decorator Richard Roberts, he said to me, "It's never going to be as beautiful as what you did because we will be using CGI, and you did absolutely everything by hand." And he said, and it just looks, it, it, we just can't match the intricacy that you got with making it real rather than using the CGI.
Oh wow. But so you didn't try and convince them that they should be doing it, they should do the real stuff instead of using CGI?
Well, producers think CGI is the magic to the magic economical solution. I'm not so sure it is.
That's true. That's true. Now, when you were making Band of Brothers, did you realize at the time that it was going to be such a momentous type of series that people will still be talking about it 25 years later?
Oh, I think so, yes. I mean, I was surprised it didn't get an Emmy or a design, I'm talking about. I think it deserved an Emmy for design.
Okay. Is it something that you still look back at as a pinnacle of your career that you worked on that, or is it just
One of
another
them.
thing that you worked on? You know, yeah.
It's one, certainly one of them.
Okay. That makes sense. And so what else is there anything else you want to tell us about your experiences working on Band of Brothers or on other things? I mean,
I made reindeer fly for Santa Claus the movie. I had to go to the Arctic and buy a herd of reindeer and bring them back to England. Good fun. And then make animatronic versions of them. And I was quite pleased that in those days we had rushes in the viewing theatre in Pinewood Studios, and the first time that the reindeer were on screen, the art department came and watched the rushes, and they all thought that they were the real animals.
Wow. Okay. See,
I was really
that's the
chuffed
biggest
with that.
compliment. That's right. That's the biggest compliment people like you can get. That that things that you've created on screen, you can't see the seam and don't know that it's been created as opposed to it being the actual thing. Wow, that's great. All right. Anything else you wanna mention?
You'll be here all night.
I don't have a problem with that, and I'm sure everyone listening will enjoy that too.
I did Band of Brothers after doing Monsignor Renard and before doing Fury. And I probably all through, I learned from all of those things. I was born in 1948, so I just after the First World War, but I grew up with my father was in the Far East fighting, and I grew up with newsreels and television and actual stories, from the people that went through it. So it was World War II's been something that I could really get into, I guess, and really, really be authentic about. I've done a little bit of World War I, which is also interesting thing to do. But then, as I say, I've also done science fiction and historical stuff. It's always an interesting challenge once you've got a script in your hands and you think, right, how am I going to make this visually right?
Right. I
Well,
mean,
that's
I see on IMDb that you also worked on War and Remembrance.
yes,
On
that's
one of
right.
the, yeah.
That's
So
right, yeah.
there's another example of World War II where you
Robert Mitchum, yeah. Yeah, that was a very interesting production. And I had to recreate the war room that where the D-Day planning was made. Again, I had great help from by visiting the government war rooms, which is a museum in London, and that gave me all sorts of inspiration. And yeah, that was good. And then with I also had to do I had to turn some buildings on an airfield into supposed to be military offices in Delhi in India. And obviously you put a few fake palm trees up outside the window, but then the interior decorated it. And I like every family, there's a box full of black and white photographs that your parents have sort of amassed over the years. And I went through that box and I found pictures of my dad, who was a captain attached to a Sikh regiment in the Indian Army during that time. So I was able to blow up black and white pictures and frame them of military stuff going on, everything else like that, which went on the walls in that junior. And there was a picture of my dad looking like Mickey Rooney on a big motorcycle, not in army uniform and everything else, but he had all the black leather coat on and everything and the flat hat. And and I got pictures of my mum, and I framed those, put them on, and I put this office that Victoria Tennant was in had three secretaries and an officer and in there. And so I made my mum somebody's girlfriend.
Oh,
And
very nice.
on there, I had my there's a little souvenir handbook of photographs of Agra that my dad had brought back from the war, put that out in there. And I found this old sort of Tappany notebook, and in it my dad had written his Urdu English dictionary, where he was trying to speak Urdu or learn it to speak to his troops. And I laid that on the desk. And Victoria Tennant came in to have a look and rehearse and everything. She picked this little notebook up, opened it up, and saw the English. Oh my goodness, she said, I'm there, I'm back in time. You
Wow.
know, that, for me, that was that's what set decor has to do.
Yeah,
Make them
for sure.
believe they're there.
Wow, really sounds that is so fascinating. So Malcolm, thank you very much for joining me and telling everyone your experiences while making Band of Brothers. So thank you very, very much. I really do
Pleasure.
appreciate it.
Been a pleasure. Thank you very much.